From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Chuck D, founder of the rap group Public Enemy. His new book has the same title as one of his most famous records, Fight the Power. Spike Lee used that record in his movie Do the Right Thing. We'll talk about Public Enemy's music and some of the controversy surrounding it. Also, On the Road with Neil Young and Crazy Horse, we'll talk with Jim Jarmusch about his new film about the band. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us what Chicago Hope has in store for us tonight after its competitor ER wowed audiences with its live episode. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Chuck D, is the leader of the rap group Public Enemy. It's been in the vanguard of rap, both for its multi-layered mixes of music and noise, and for its politically charged lyrics. One of their best-known songs, Fight the Power, was used in Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing. Chuck D has called rap music the Black CNN, but as music critic John Perellis has written, Public Enemy also has a knack for shooting itself in the foot. He was referring to the controversy surrounding anti-Semitic comments from one of the group's members. Public Enemy has had 3 multi-platinum albums and 3 gold LPs. This year, Chuck D became a commentator for the national Fox News channel. Now he has a new book called Fight the Power, Rap, Race, and Reality. Spike Lee wrote the introduction. This is Public Enemy's Power to the People.
And you thought the beat slowed down? Come on! Turn me loose! Just turn it up! Power to the people, y'all! Before P.E. got a brand new funk, turn it up, boom the trunk, yeah, internationally known on the microphone, making sure the brothers will never leave you alone, to my sisters, sisters, yes, we missed ya, let's get it together, make a nation, you can bet on it, don't sleep in it, cause the troops go deep in it.
Chuck D, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm all right.
In your new book, you point out that most rap artists were born after 1967, whereas everyone in your group was born between 1958 and 61. How do you think that makes your point of view different in your lyrics?
I just think I was able to visualize the whole decade of the 60s, and I definitely was a recipient of all the surrounding events. So when 1986 came around, and it was the 10th year, I guess, of rap music, sort of, or the 7th year of recording, the topics were in me, and I didn't have to really go into trying to discover them in depth as much as, you know, some of the younger guys. So I went into something that that was relative to myself.
Public Enemy is also known for its layered sound mixes. How did that become a part of the group?
The processes of trying to invent something that was different, trying to be as diverse as possible, and coming from a background of many different musical styles, which we believe that hip-hop is a blend and a hybrid of all kinds of musics. And, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I was more into sports. So when I did listen to music and I listened to radio, I listened to pretty much AM pop radio. So you heard everything from the Rolling Stones to Love and Spoonful, Chicago, the Spinners, Elton John, things like that. So that combination allowed us to come up with weird layering blends.
Tell me about creating the image of Public Enemy, how you dressed, what you did on stage, what the look was on stage.
Well, the look was on stage was like kind of represent some of the look on the streets, but what the S1Ws had done is you know, take a combination of Fruit of Islam and Black Panther Party look with the berets and the black suits. And actually, they had dressed that way to be, you know, they were security for our mobile gigs that we used to have out in Long Island. So when they actually, you know, when we actually put this group together, myself and Hank Shockley thought that they would be a good component to the group to add a look, and that they did. Flavor and myself wore regular street gear. You know, we started out wearing these little clocks because that was the style of high school kids at the time. And then Flavor just kept, you know, wearing his clock as the clocks got bigger. I took my clock off after the first year. But, you know, the clock signified what time it was, which meant that, you know, you had to know what was happening.
So tell me more about the image of having bodyguards on stage.
Well, they wasn't really bodyguards. Security, the first world, signified, well, it had a double meaning. It was like they would call themselves security of the first world because, you know, we felt that we as black people were first world people. And security, you know, spoke up for the fact that our culture, our language, our whole background and known black background was taken away from us. And the security of the first world or symbol to present the fact that we would never allow it to, you know, happen again. And, you know, there was also a symbol because in the beginning, you know, the S1Ws held Uzis. And the Uzi signified, you know, the whole aspect of black culture was stolen with the threat of the gun used by the Western Hemisphere and the European civilization. And when they used the gun to abduct us from a land that we pretty much, you know, were peaceful and civil at, then we used it as a symbol as the S1Ws being the security of the first world, not allowing this to happen again in symbol.
Were they real Uzis or fake Uzis?
Next question.
Uh-oh. Sorry, you can't answer that?
Why what?
Why can't you answer that?
Because I choose not to.
All right. you know, that's a kind of elaborate metaphor that you're using for the Uzis, but I think the way they've really been seen is these guys are really tough. They've got guns. They're really macho.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the way you'd see it if you were in the audience as opposed to an elaborate metaphor about how the culture was stolen.
I think number one is that, you know, people were shocked at that time. They had never seen black organization like this in that particular type of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, black men in uniforms, they don't look like they're in the Army or the U.S. Navy or anything. They just look like they're in it for themselves.
So, now, you know, Uzis make an appearance in a lot of groups' rap lyrics in bragging about how tough they are. And how...
My second record was called My Uzi Weighs a Ton.
Right, and what was that about, though?
It was a metaphor to use the way I rattled off words from my tongue.
Right. Yeah. So.
The way I rattled off words, like da 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 da, you know, like, you know, at that particular time, an Uzi, which was a very popular, I guess, Israeli, you know, created weapon, was actually a word that was going around.
Right, but the rap that you just mentioned, My Uzi Weighs a Ton, wasn't really about shooting up the neighborhood or, you know,
facing
off with the police or anything, whereas a lot of rap lyrics about Uzis are, and I'm wondering what you thought of those lyrics.
I believe that things that happen in the community bring up a topic and a discussion, and every story and word should be said, because if you don't allow it to happen, it's censorship. But I believe the projection of the projections of balance and character are not as fair as they should be. So therefore, there's a lopsided projection of a negative point of view coming from a black community, and I don't think everything is negative.
My guest is Chuck D of the rap group Public Enemy. He has a new book called Fight the Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Chuck D of the rap group Public Enemy.
Let me play one of the better known, one of the most popular raps from Public Enemy, and this is Don't Believe the Hype. Just before we hear it, what are some of the things that you were reacting against in this particular track?
You know, just telling people don't fall victim to being programmed. Not saying don't believe anything, but challenge information. I mean, even today, we're in just as much of a misinformation age as we are in the information age. So you have to be able to challenge the so-called fact with some situations or some background and research before you actually believe it. In this country right here in the United States, people here are still a headline-soaking in audience, so to speak. And instead of the headline, get into the story.
Well, let's hear Don't Believe the Hype. This is Public Enemy. My guest is Chuck D., the lead vocalist of the group.
Don't. Here's what I want you all to do for me.
Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the roll below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the friend guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
cause some they never had this.
Number one. Never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome of public enemy. Used, abused without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
My guest is Chuck D of Public Enemy, and he's written a new book called Fight the Power, Rap, Race, and Reality. Let's get to one of the probably the most controversial part of Public Enemy's career to date.
Depending on who you're talking about.
Right, okay. Right, okay. Well, this is referring to the time when Professor Griff, the Minister of Information with the group, said in an interview with David Mills of the Washington Times things like, the Jews are wicked and we can prove this. He said that the Jews are responsible for the vast majority of wickedness that goes on across the globe. You quote him as saying in your book that, is it a coincidence that the Jews run the jewelry business and it's named Jewelry?
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the role of jewels in the slave trade. So I know you see Public Enemy as being about educating its listeners. What message did you think that gave?
I think it was informative in a certain way, but I just think a lot of things that he was saying were, presented wrong. And, of course, when you make statements like wicked around the world and you make a blanket statement, that just blocks out any kind of information that you might have. And that was the discussion then and there.
You said it was informative in a certain way. I don't really know what that means.
Informative in a certain way. If you say that people, when Griff was talking about, he was just talking about certain people that had a firm grip on the background or the home of our of our people. I mean, European nations have a firm grip on the control of Africans even to this day. The United States has a firm grip on a lot of people around the world to this day. But you got to be clear and precise about naming individuals and not making blanket statements about their affiliations with religions. So what I mean, it was sort of informative because when you look at who owns the diamond mines, why the hell are they there anyway? And what are their names? And why are they still mining diamonds today when black people have been there since the beginning of time? And all you had to do is ask a lot of questions. And then when people start ducking the questions and then running like roaches, then you're pretty much on the up and up instead of behind the ball.
So your point, I think, is that
I don't think there's a black guy running diamond mines.
So your point is that Jewish people run the diamond mines in South Africa. Jews were responsible for a lot of the slave trade, but let's be specific about it. That's your point?
Let's be real specific about it. Let's name names. Let's name addresses and heirs and people like that and benefactors. I think using Jewish people as a phrase to me was not a great move, not a good move at all, because, you know, a person that follows religion follows it to the T. And those people might have said, okay, I'm a Jew, but, you know, Jewish to me, Judaism is a religion. And the people that do wickedly deeds, they have no religion at all except for the religion of the devil. So they couldn't even call themselves Jews as much as they think they were born into it. I just don't follow that principle or belief. I can't buy that. I'm sorry. I have to be convinced, and I have yet to been convinced about that.
To be convinced about what?
About a person's religion, them being born into it. I don't believe that.
So you mean just if you're born into Judaism doesn't necessarily make you a Jew?
No. Mm-mm.
So you can distance yourself from it if you want to? Is that what you're saying?
That's a philosophy. And, you know, for example, being born black has something to do with skin tone. You know, really. It's a skin tone. Through white world supremacy, the whole idea of race and color separation came from that. It didn't come from black people. If you look around the world is made up of a whole bunch of different philosophies, beliefs, and colors. This black-white thing is ridiculous, but it's made up by the whole fact of a Eurocentric white world supremacist belief of separating the races. So when a person is born black, you know, the fact that it has nothing to do with the skin tone is a ridiculous concept that has been placed upon us as people, human beings.
Let me ask you, can you understand why people were uncomfortable with your criticism of Minister Griff? I mean, the elaborate explanation that you just gave is still a little confusing.
Well, there's a lot of things I'm uncomfortable about in America. There's a lot of things I'm uncomfortable about in the background, so people have to take that in consideration. Weigh and judge it, sit down and debate and, you know, and come up with their clear, concise reasons why everything in the past, in the history, was cool or uncool, depending on them.
I guess.
I told people, Griff was wrong, but you know what? Let's talk now. You know, if that brought up the situation, let's talk. And let's talk about, for example, when I talk about reparations in this country, I want to talk about people that have benefited off the slave trade that still have money today, whether they're in Europe or whether they're in the United States. This is still an unclaimed and untalked about issue. Reparations in this country right now is still a passed over issue. It's cool for Clinton to apologize, but, you know, the 40 acres and the mule, that's what people are waiting for in a certain sense of the word, in terms. And not only for the destruction of black Americans, but the destruction of black people within the continent of Africa. I think European nations owe money or whatever form to rebuild it and find it the way they, you know, and rebuild it in the way that they found it.
Well, just to sum up here, Griff said that Jews are responsible for the majority of wickedness in the world.
Yeah, he's wrong.
Okay, but that's what you were saying was, well, he should have named names. He should have been more specific.
You should always name names and be specific and don't make blanket statements.
You don't sound very uncomfortable with the concept, though. You know,
say what?
It doesn't sound like a very, it's a kind of tepid.
I don't care what you think it sounds like. I don't care about that. I'm telling you.
No, what do you mean you don't care?
I don't care what you think.
you don't care what I think. Okay.
No, I don't care what you think. I'm telling you straight out, right? And I don't care what you feel about what I'm talking about. I'm telling you straight out, he was wrong. You don't make blanket statements about a people when most people are innocent, all right? You name names, you name individuals. You don't name their religious affiliation. That's ridiculous. You name individuals and you name that clique, so to speak. That's what you do. And I went over that. It's almost like been there, done that. I went through it. I named it in the book. I went through the whole thing in my book. And matter of fact, you see some names that are named. So let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the murders of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur had a big personal effect on you, and also if they've had an effect on performing and how you see other people.
First of all, it's just a ridiculous concept that we had two of the guys at the top, Mr. One and Mr. 1A, and they were both murdered, shot. They haven't found the killers. It's just uncanny. It's just unbelievable. And that's no pun intended, because that was one of Biggie's songs. And right now I'm just confused just by the aspect of that happening. And before they even were shot, a lot of people were posturing, you know, reflecting the violence in the hood and trying to envelop that philosophy within their act, which kind of like scared off the rest of the female audience in rap music, at least until Puffy Combs actually has brought it back. So Puffy Combs has brought back the female audience, which is a good thing. But before then, you know, the live shows disappeared with the disappearing of the female audience as they flocked towards R&B.
Do you think that part of the reason why women weren't showing up for rap concerts is the lack of respect they were given in rap music?
No, I think you had a whole bunch of young crooners come by, form of Boyz II Men and Jodeci, and I don't care how much a rapper is rapping, nothing gets a female's attention more than somebody that's on his knees with a rose in his mouth singing love to them.
Well, it is interesting that rap music has had so little in the way of love ballads. I mean, because usually, like, especially in like teenage music, there's mm-hmm. such a long history of the romantic ballad, right, along with the more,
people,
you know, aggressive. Yeah, right.
People fall in love every year, you know.
You ever miss that side of performing?
What? What's that?
The romantic side. Did you ever wish that there was, that Chuck D had like a kind of romantic ballad side?
No, I can't sing a lick. I can't uh-huh. play instruments. I yell and I scream. So this would be like comparable to, you know, Led Zeppelin. You know, it's just like, you know, with, I guess, white males, you know, Led Zeppelin or metal rock or straight up rock and roll becomes very energetic and you move around and it becomes athletic.
Even Led Zeppelin would have something like Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah, and I've had some things that brought the tempo down every once in a while. But, I believe if you cannot sing, don't even go into that zone. You have people who are natural singers. You have people that have the ability to sing, and that's their chunk of entertainment, and I admire them for that. I mean, I'm a big fan of Motown in the 60s, so. You know, if I want to hear me something slow jam, I'll, you know, turn on something by Otis Redding.
Chuck D will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is Fight the Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
To get up or get down. 911 is joking, yo, damn. Get up or get down. Late 911, where's the late crown? Get up or get down. 911 is joking, yo, damn. Get up or get down.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Chuck D. Also, film director Jim Jarmusch talks about going on the road with one of his favorite bands, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, for a new rock and roll movie. And TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's season opener of Chicago Hope.
Show.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Chuck D, founder of the rap group Public Enemy. He's also a commentator for the Fox News Channel, and now he has a new book called Fight the Power. One of your most famous records was used for the soundtrack of Do the Right Thing, and that's Fight the Power.
Mm-hmm.
Fight the powers that be. What power? Which power do you want people
powers,
to fight?
The powers in the black community is all those that control the black community from the outside going in. The powers of a lot of different things, economics, education, enforcement, you know, the powers that keep the black community remaining in the plantation state that it remains in. So with that in mind, you want to fight the powers to get that foot off your neck. And that's just your human right to get a foot off your neck.
What influence do you hope your lyrics have had on your listeners?
To be able to look at information clearly, disseminate it, and then use it for their own good.
One last question. What have you been listening to now, musically?
Me?
Yeah.
I bought this Rhino box set of 100 records from the 60s.
The soul
yeah,
music box?
Yeah, Beg, Scream, Shout.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Bought that. Of course, Hendrix stays in my collection.
Uh-huh.
The first Funkadelic album, Free Your Mind. As for Busta Rhymes, O.C.
Yeah.
O.C. has the latest album. There's a good young rapper that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading Sweet Soul Music.
Peter Guralnick's book?
Yeah, Peter Guralnick's book. I just bought Gladys Knight's book yesterday.
Uh-huh.
High Record Story, which is three sets of CDs on everything out of High Records in Memphis. That's you know, heavily, and also making the next record. So, you know, hearing also Traffic's first couple albums, another group, Traffic, Stevie mm-hmm, Winwood mm-hmm. and all them.
Any samples from that likely to show up on your next record?
Nah, I can't say anything about that, and definitely not. I don't think I'm going to use a Traffic sample and get my tail sued. That ain't happening.
Well, yeah, actually, you don't usually credit the people that you sample, right?
I don't sample.
Yeah, in the book you actually mentioned that you keep the samples unnamed, so you won't get sued and don't have to pay royalties.
Well, that's back in the day. Well, basically what we do is we desecrate the sample.
Uh-huh.
That's almost like taking a sound and splitting it up into three elements, and, you know, we took an element. You know, what we dealt with is the elements of sound as opposed to the sample composition, and that's two different things. I'm not
right.
going to pay anybody for a sound, especially as much as my sounds have been taken.
Has that been tested in court yet, by the way, whether if you totally break up a riff, whether that would be...
You think I'm going to trust the courts?
Well, I didn't ask that.
I don't give a damn if it is in
but,
the court
but just,
or not.
Uh-huh.
Because my whole thing is that if somebody sues me, and, you know, I'm into a thing of you know, look, if you sue me, I'm suing you back. And you're not going to find a case where you're going to win.
But the thing is, you know, that what you're by saying that, you're depriving artists who made the original record of more royalties.
And
the credit for
not
their
when
music.
You use, not when you use sound elements, no. You should only pay if you take the composition of song.
Mm-hmm.
The composition of song is what you have to pay for. The composition of lyric, composition of song and arrangement. But an element of sound, no. I mean, if you invent a machine like a lawnmower and I take that lawnmower sound and I arrange it in my own composition, I'm the songwriter. I've took an element of sound. Sound belongs to everything on the planet. You can take a bird's chirp and make a song out of it. That's what you own. You own the song. You don't own the sound.
Well, we're out of time. Chuck D, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Terry.
Chuck D is the founder of Public Enemy. His new book is Fight the Power.
Getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm. that beat.
As the rhythm's designed to bounce with calcium, that the rhyme designed to fill your mind.
Coming up, Jim Jarmusch's new movie about Neil Young and Crazy Horse. This is Fresh Air. A new movie takes us on the road with the band Neil Young and Crazy Horse. They made their first recording together, Cinnamon Girl, in 1969, and they have recorded together on and off ever since. The movie Year of the Horse was directed by Jim Jarmusch, Jarmusch's first work with Neil Young in 1995, when Young did the music for Jarmusch's film Dead Man. Jarmusch's other movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Night on Earth, and Mystery Train. The American Museum of the Moving Image recently honored him with a film retrospective. Before we hear from Jarmusch, let's hear one of the performances captured on the new film Year of the Horse.
Once there was a friend of mine who died a thousand deaths. His life was filled with parasites. Countless idle threats. He trusted in a woman, and on her he made his bet. Once there was a friend of mine who died a thousand deaths.
I asked filmmaker Jim Jarmusch why he's so passionate about Neil Young's music.
Well, I think the first Neil Young that I heard that made an impression was the song Broken Arrow, Buffalo Springfield, which was when I was a teenager in Akron. And that song was very, there was something almost cinematic about it. So many images, it just worked on me in some way. And then the next record that really affected me was the first one with Crazy Horse. Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. And since then, I've been really particularly a fan of Neil Young when he plays with Crazy Horse, although I like some of his other work, but I'm really a fan of Neil Young and Crazy Horse.
Now, whose idea was the documentary on Neil Young and Crazy Horse?
That was Neil's idea, if it is, in fact, a documentary. I'm not sure exactly what to call the thing.
Concert but, film? What's your choice?
I just call it a rock and roll movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because it's not really a documentary and it's not purely a concert film, so I'm not sure what it is. But what happened was after Neil did the score for Dead Man, he asked me to do a video for his soundtrack release of the Dead Man music, which I did. And then after that, he asked me to do a video for the most recent Crazy Horse album at that time, Broken Arrow, a song called Big Time. And that was shot all on Super 8 film, and I shot it around where Neil lives in Northern California and in a small club where the band played. And after that, he called up saying, hey, you know, we should try to make a film that looks like that, because we like the way the Super 8 material looked and how it kind of fit with the rawness of their music. So I just went out on the road and started making this film with the help of L.A. Johnson, who organized the shoot and was the other Super 8 cameraman on the film besides myself.
Now, I find it interesting that doing this movie was Neil Young's idea, because one of the guys in Crazy Horse makes some, I think, insulting and condescending comments to you as you're making the movie, and these comments are actually a part of the movie. He basically accuses you of being an artsy film director. He's going to ask a couple of cute questions and expect that the answers will actually capture the band.
Yeah, that's Pancho Frank Sampedro, the guitar player. And in fact, his insults are, I take as compliments, because he's one of those kind of people that if he didn't like you, he wouldn't bother to insult you. So we get along really well. But I thought his comments were really important in the film, because this is a band that's been together for almost 30 years. And somehow it's very difficult to just kind of appear and try to make a portrait of these people and where their music comes from. It's really impossible, in fact. So the film, I thought it was important to have him in the film saying, you know, you can't capture 30 years of our lives and our emotions and all the people we've lost and all the things we've been through together and our families and our drug habits and all these things that have happened to us by just asking us some dumb questions. So to me, it's an important part of the film because the film is not intended to be that insightful in the first place. It's not scrutinizing the band and these people as human beings, and it's not that in-depth. It's more a celebration of their longevity and a celebration of the kind of music they make with some insights into where it comes from, but nothing as deep as, say, a film like Don't Look Back, which is one of my favorite rock and roll movies.
Weren't you a little offended by the comment, though, and by his ignorance of who you were, reducing you to, you know, a generic artsy filmmaker? I don't think of you as artsy.
Well, he was trying to tease me. I mean, he was being insulting in a joking way, so I didn't take offense to that. Some other people, that would be very offensive to me.
Jim Jarmusch is my guest, and his new movie is a documentary concert film on Neil Young and Crazy Horse. I know when you were in film school, you were Nicholas Ray's teaching assistant, Nicholas Ray, whose films include Rebel Without a Cause and Johnny Guitar. What was your favorite of his films?
Well, I really love his first film, They Live by Night.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many of his films, On Dangerous Ground and In a Lonely Place and the ones you mentioned, Johnny Guitar. I like Wind Across the Everglades. I love the Lusty Men with Robert Mitchum. Rebel Without a Cause certainly was really a great film, an important film to me. But he made so many great films, you know. It's hard for me to pick what my favorites. I think They Live by Night may be my most favorite at the moment.
Is there anything you could put your finger on that you could say you learned from working with Nicholas Ray?
Yeah, a lot of things. But the most important things he told me were, while making a film, think of each scene as its own little world and don't worry about how it connects to the other scenes. That's something you can worry about when you're writing. But when you're shooting a film, think only about the scene that you're working on, and don't, if you can, shoot out of sequence so that even the actors are not thinking about, okay, now what just happened before this and what just happened now. Just think about what is happening at that moment, which really has helped me a lot, and I think maybe affected how I even how I write, because I think of things in little scenes that are sort of exist in and of themselves.
Why is that good advice?
Well, I think when you make a film, you are collaborating, and for me, collaborating with the actors is extremely important. And I think if you focus on, you know, it's a very hard thing for an actor to be a character at an exact moment when you say action. Now suddenly they have to be this person. It's complicated and it's delicate. And I think if you focus on that particular moment or little sequence of things within a scene, then you can really be their guide for them as a director. You're their audience and you're collaborating with them, and I think it helps a lot to find the kind of the reality of the moment for that character if you just shut off everything else. He also told me that the meaning of a scene may be different for each of the actors' characters. So you should talk to the actors separately about the scene. You can rehearse it together and work together, but you as the director or writer-director know the intention of that scene in terms of the overall story, but it may mean different things for different characters. So sometimes you should speak to them separately and be aware of what that moment means for them and not just throw out a general thing of what it's supposed to say. So both of those things kind of lead you to focus on a particular point of view of a certain character, one of the characters in the story that you're telling. I don't know, I found those very helpful. Another thing that he taught me was that your inspiration will come from everything, not just from cinema. It might come from baseball, it might come from architecture, it might come from watching a way a certain person walks on the street. And he told me all of these things are really valuable. So people who just live and eat and breathe and sleep in a film world will not be, you know, will not bring as many things to the films that they create.
Well, one of the things you did outside of the film world, you were in a new wave band. I don't know if you were already making movies yet, but I think the band was called the Del Byzantines, T-E-E-N-S.
I don't remember. I'm blanking out. I blank out on this period.
Oh, no, or yeah, repress it was, or something, yeah.
I was in a band that played in New York in the late 70s, really in the early 80s. And so I was making films, too, at the same time, or starting to, anyway. But that was a kind of period when I remember at one point where there were posters up all over the East Village, flyers that said, "Everyone here is in a band." And it was kind of the case back then. Almost everyone I knew was in some kind of rock and roll group.
Do you think that what you were looking for in music was similar to what you were looking for in film?
Well, yeah, although music to me is a more pure form. I'm jealous of musicians. I think I maybe have the soul of a musician that got sidetracked into making films due to circumstances in my life, or I don't know why. But I'm really, I don't know, a musician can just sit down and express something so immediately. And also the way that music is a kind of language. And when people play music together and, you know, Crazy Horse and the Neil Young film, the film Year of the Horse is a good example, because if you take any one of those guys out of the band, you don't have the band anymore. And it's something about how they communicate together as musicians that makes this particular sound. And there's something about that I really love. I love the fact that music is like a language that everyone seems to be able to speak, you know. I just love, music is really the thing that inspires me the most.
Well, Jim Jarmusch, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Jim Jarmusch's movie about Neil Young and Crazy Horse, Year of the Horse, has opened in New York. It opens Friday in L.A., then opens in other cities. Here's more music from the film.
I was walking down Main Street, not the sidewalk, but Main Street, dodging traffic with flying feet. That's how good I felt. Took a spin in the laundromat, played a game at the music arcade, kept winning while the band played. That's how good I felt. Have you ever been lost? Have you ever been found out? Have you ever been all alone at the end of the day? Yeah, I'm talking about getting down. Take it easy, there's no one around. Just a mirror and you and me and the TV screen. There's a comet in the sky tonight. Makes me feel like I'm all right. I'm moving pretty fast for my size. I didn't really mean to stay as long as I have. So I'll be moving on.
Coming up, the season opener of Chicago Hope. This is Fresh Air.
The NBC medical series ER began its season with an unusual episode that was broadcast live. Tonight, its CBS counterpart, Chicago Hope, presents an unusual season opener, a drama with music. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
10 years ago in England, the BBC presented a musical miniseries called The Singing Detective, starring Michael Gambon as a writer hospitalized for a chronic, horribly disfiguring skin condition. Dennis Potter, who wrote The Singing Detective, suffered from the same condition, and the 6-part drama was an amazing mixture of memories, confrontations, realizations, and musical hallucinations. Although The Singing Detective has never been shown on any network in America, many individual public TV stations showed the Dennis Potter miniseries over here in 1988 and a few times since. Back then, I said it was the best thing I'd ever seen written expressly for television. And nothing since then has changed my mind. One great piece of Singing Detective news is that the entire series, which has never been available on home video, is finally being released next week by the BBC and 20th Century Fox. If you've never seen television's premier dramatic masterpiece, now's your chance. Meanwhile, the other piece of Singing Detective news is that the producers of Chicago Hope obviously love Dennis Potter's work just as much as I do. Tonight's show is a full-length salute to the Singing Detective, with the same sort of lip-syncing and goofy choreography and complex storylines. There are trips down memory lane and key character revelations and all sorts of conflicts brought to the surface and resolved. At the center of the Chicago Hope version is Adam Arkin's Dr. Shutt, who quits his job as chief neurosurgeon, suffers a brain aneurysm the same day, and hallucinates his way through the high-risk operation that follows. Most of the characters lip-sync to familiar versions of old songs. The Four Seasons' Walk Like a Man, Melanie's Brand New Key, Dean Martin's Ain't That a Kick in the Head, but not all of them. In one hallucination, Aaron Shutt imagines he is about to operate on himself and drill into his own skull when he hears music. The song, and the voice, comes from Mandy Patinkin as Dr. Jeffrey Geiger, whose character was the center of Chicago Hope and Aaron's best friend, until he left the series 2 seasons ago. Suddenly, he's back, and their imagined reunion is absolutely priceless.
Yes, why don't you hand me that, the twirly thing over there.
The drill?
Yes, the drill. Thank you. So, let's get ready to make a big hole.
You and I must make a pact. We must bring salvation.
I didn't ask for music.
Where there is love.
Hello? I didn't ask for music.
I'll be there. I'll reach out.
What are you doing? Jeffrey, don't start this crap, okay? You are not there. You're never there. You're not even there now. You're just a figment of my imagination, and I don't have to pay attention to you. I don't.
I'll be there.
I'm not hearing you. I don't hear this. Not hearing. Ah, la, 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 la. Ah, la. Hey, why is that your real voice?
Because this is my voice.
Shut up! Shut the hell up! Stop with the singing! You know something? I'm gonna tell you something. I have never liked your singing. Never! It is inappropriate, it's awkward, it's embarrassing, and I...
Well, it's all
jealous.
Jealous? You're jealous of me? Whew, that's something I never knew about you, Aaron. Don't be jealous of me. I'm crazy, unbalanced. You'd never be jealous of me.
Hey, I'm just as surprised as you are. You can sing your pain, Jeffrey. I can't. I'm stuck having to feel mine.
Don't be jealous of me. I'm singing because it's easier than talking. It's like a mask. It's one step from reality. That's how I feel free.
But that's what I want. I can't take it anymore, okay? I have screwed everything up. My relationships, my career, my marriage.
whole life is out of control.
Then sing. There's nothing to stop you.
Watch and tape tonight's Chicago Hope, then get hold of a copy of Dennis Potter's The Singing Detective next week and watch that, too. It'll be obvious within minutes where Chicago Hope got its inspiration. Oh, and if you're still not convinced, catch the name of the brain specialist called in to operate on Aaron tonight. Her name is Denise Potter.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.